From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Leonard Feather. Throughout his career, the well-known jazz critic has led efforts to bring racial and sexual equality to jazz. Also today, I talk with theater impresario Joseph Papp. His New York Shakespeare Festival has just begun a complete six-year cycle of Shakespeare's plays. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of a 1972 album by pianist Jay McShann, titled Goin' to Kansas City. And there's a new entrant into the 1988 presidential race. He's the creation of Gary Trudeau, and he stars in a new HBO spoof of political campaigns. TV critic David Bianculli has a preview. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Leonard Feather. He's probably the best-known jazz critic in America. His three-volume Encyclopedia of Jazz is the standard reference book on the subject. He's also contributed to jazz as a composer and record producer. Together with the late record producer John Hammond, Feather helped lead the campaign to bring racial equality to jazz. Feather also worked to open up jazz to women musicians. He's written a memoir of his life in jazz. It's titled The Jazz Years, Ear Witness to an Era, and it's published by DeCapo Press. Leonard Feather grew up in England in the 1920s and 30s. I asked him if he had access to many jazz records then.
There wasn't too much in person, but there was a certain amount on records. Actually, the reason I got into the music world in the first place was listening to a record of Louis Armstrong, West End Blues, which was released in England, which made a tremendous impression on me. And it was fairly easy to buy a substantial number of American recordings, but there were not very many British jazz musicians of any consequence. That's why I started coming to New York.
How did you start writing about jazz? There really weren't many people writing seriously about that music.
No, it was really almost by accident. I wrote a letter to the editor of The Melody Maker, a London publication, which turned out to be kind of provocative. I asked why there wasn't any jazz in 3/4 time, which apparently at that time seemed very revolutionary. And there were a lot of letters attacking me and defending me and so forth. And as a result of that, and another controversial letter that I sent in, I got to meet the editor of The Melody Maker, and he asked me if I'd like to write an article for them. So I just started writing regularly for that publication and eventually for a number of others, including American publications.
And you knew that that's what you wanted to do?
Well, yeah, within a couple of years, I decided that I was working at a film studio outside London for very little money and absolutely no satisfaction. So finally, I was making more money on the outside and enjoying myself more, writing about music and also writing music, which I'd begun to do around the same time. And I decided that was where my future lay, so I gave up the job with the movie company and went on my first visit to New York.
How did this go over in your family? In your autobiography, you describe your family as a Jewish middle-class family that expected conformity.
Yes, they really couldn't quite figure me out for a while. I suppose I seemed to be some kind of a strange rebel to them, and they really didn't quite understand the music or why I was involved in it. But then when they began to see my name in the papers a lot and began to see that I was making a very good living for myself and I was writing music and producing records and doing all these things, they accepted it.
You went to America in 1935. Did you have plans? Mm-hmm. Did you know what you'd be doing once you got there?
Well, yes. I was very fortunate in having met John Hammond, whom you presumably know about, who was the great talent scout of jazz history. He had discovered Count Basie and Billie Holiday and so many other people. And John met me at the dock when I got off the Normandy and took me around. I think within the first 24 hours, I'd been to the Apollo Theater in Harlem and the Savoy Ballroom and went to a number of other places with John and with other friends that I made on that visit. And it was just sort of getting to know what was then my spiritual home, in effect. And I came back on several other visits and eventually settled in New York and lived there for 20 years before moving out to California.
Jazz was very segregated in the 1930s when you came to America, even in the North. What were some of the manifestations of that kind of segregation up north in New York where you were?
I had some very shocking experiences. I had read about racism, and I had read some of the black newspapers, and I had made a couple of black friends in England, principally Louis Armstrong, who came to visit there, and a bit later, Bennie Carter, who's a close friend of mine to this day. But I really wasn't quite prepared for what I encountered when I came to New York. One time I was soliciting ads for the Melody Maker. That was the only way I could get them to subsidize my trip to New York. And I went to see the manager of a band leader named Freddie Martin, who's dead now. And the manager looked at a dummy page that I'd set up, which had a picture of Duke Ellington, whose manager had taken an ad. And he looked at me with a blank expression and said, "What? You want to put Freddie on the same page with a nigger?" And that was quite a shock to me, to say the least. And there were things like that happening all the time. I invited Andy Kirk, a great black band leader, to my hotel for a drink, and we were forced to use the freight elevator in my hotel. I ran across situations like that that I really had not been prepared for, but of course black Americans were prepared for it, and they lived their lives that way. And this is, I'm talking about 50 years ago, but it didn't get much better for a long, long time.
This is something I guess you couldn't have been really aware of in England, where there wasn't a very large black population.
Exactly. It was a very small black population in those days, and but there was discrimination, but it was not as overt as it was in the United States. And, of course, there were no lynchings in England, thank God.
Some of the clubs in New York were segregated. The performers were frequently black, but the audiences were white. I'm thinking especially of the Cotton Club. What was the attitude that you and John Hammond, who was your guide at the beginning, toward going to clubs like that? Would you go to hear a big band at
no,
a segregated
I never
club?
Went to the Cotton Club, and in a way I kind of regret it in retrospect, because I would have been curious to see what it was really like. But I had heard that black people were prevented from going to the club as patrons. They were only used as employees, as performers. And since I objected to that in principle, I didn't want to be a part of that kind of an attitude, and I never went there. I went to a lot of other clubs in Harlem that did not discriminate, like Small's Paradise and so forth. But the Cotton Club is one place I never did see, except in that terrible movie they made a couple of years ago.
You didn't like it?
Oh, it was awful. They hardly had Duke Ellington in it at all, and it was just a gangster movie. It could have been a very interesting movie about the great stars of black show business, but it wasn't.
Both you and John Hammond became very active in trying to desegregate jazz. What were some of the things that you did in that direction?
I think one of the most important things I did was organize a panel of experts for Esquire magazine, along with the late Robert Goffin, who was a Belgian jazz expert. And we put this panel of experts together. And when the winners were announced, it was decided by Esquire magazine to place them all in a concert together and have the concert very widely publicized. It was the first concert ever given at the Metropolitan Opera House. And what was interesting about it was that up until that time, most of the jazz polls had been in Downbeat and Metronome magazines, and the winners were for the most part white. Most white musicians had a great advantage, regardless of their talent or lack of it, over blacks. Whereas in our poll, with the experts voting, not the public, the majority of the winners were black. People like Louis Armstrong and Roy Aldridge and Art Tatum and so forth, who had not, for the most part, won awards before. And they all took part together in this fantastic concert at the Metropolitan Opera House. And there was another concert the following year out here at the Philharmonic in Los Angeles. And I think that drew attention to a lot of great black musicians on the broadcast that we had of those events, and in the magazine, which ran regular features on jazz, which I wrote along with other writers for several years.
You also worked for a time at Cafe Society, which was the first mixed club in New York. What was different about Cafe Society than the other clubs of the period?
Well, the main difference was that the manager was an owner, a man named Barney Josephson, and the talent consultant unofficially was John Hammond. And between them, they managed to get some of the great talents of the day, like Billie Holiday, Teddy Wilson and his orchestra, the famous boogie-woogie pianist, many, many others. Hazel Scott was a big hit there, too. And in addition to having a lot of great black talent and some fine white talent also, they did not discriminate at all in their treatment of customers. And unfortunately, in those days, there was still a certain amount of residual discrimination at the clubs on 52nd Street and elsewhere in town. So Cafe Society was sort of a haven of freedom from prejudice at a time when it was very difficult to find a club like that in New York. And I was the assistant to the press agent for that room, so I had access to it at all times. I could go and see Lena Horne working there and all these other great artists, and it was truly a thrill.
My guest is jazz critic, composer, and producer Leonard Feather, who's just written an autobiography titled The Jazz Years, Ear Witness to an Era. You know, we were talking about how you became aware of racial friction in jazz when you came to America. You also got a chance to be in on recording sessions as opposed to just listening to the final record that was produced. You produced many sessions yourself, but even before that, you sat in on sessions that were being produced. You have a very interesting description of a Fats Waller session in your book, which I think you found really discouraging in a lot of ways. Would you describe what that session was like and how it compared to what you'd expect to hear?
It was very informal. I mean, Fats just had a couple of bottles of whiskey on the piano, and they were looking through some of these terrible tunes that were assigned to him, which was not his fault. The record company wanted him to do certain dog tunes, as we call them, and he did the best he could and usually made fun of them on the records. And there was one particular song of the session I went to called If You're a Viper, which is an old-fashioned expression for a pot smoker. And it was just a funny song and innocuous. There were other records made of it. But Fats made this record, and the people at the company, which was RCA Victor, decided they didn't want to put it out, and they just junked it. And Fats was very upset about that. But in general, I found that the whole setting for these recordings was extremely informal. There were practically no arrangements, and Fats just went and did the best he could with all these absurd songs that he was given.
You also describe him as having a bottle of gin on one side and two foxy women on either side of the piano.
Yeah, that's approximately right, yeah. He had a good time. He was a very happy-go-lucky personality, and unfortunately his fast life caught up with him, and he died at the age of 39. But he was a magnificent talent. People remember him as a comedian and a singer, but actually he was one of the great jazz pianists of all time. It's very sad that so few films are made of him actually playing the piano. Most of the film shorts that I've seen having mainly singing.
There's a certain tension I felt reading that description of the session, a tension between Fats Waller and his producer. His producer wanted him to record stuff he wasn't especially interested in.
Right.
The producer thought that different songs were good, different songs from the ones Fats Waller liked best.
Right.
And I think that there's a long history of that in jazz production, and I wonder when you started to produce records yourself, what lessons did you feel you learned from watching other sessions be produced and watching the typical frictions between the musician and the producer?
Well, I think it was a difference because I started producing records in London when Benny Carter came there as arranger for the BBC Dance Orchestra. I got permission to produce some sessions with Benny, and I just let the artist do exactly what he wanted to do. I never imposed any restrictions on anybody that I ever recorded. And later on, that was very, very successful in terms of some of the people I discovered and was the first to record. George Shearing was one of them in London and later in New York. And I made the first Sarah Vaughan records and the first Dinah Washington records. And in her case, I wrote some blues for her that were very successful. And a lot of others. And in general, I just ran the sessions very, very loosely and gave the artist pretty much of a free hand. We would agree on what material was to be done, but I would never force him to do anything he didn't want to do.
Yeah, you mentioned George Shearing. It was actually your idea to get the quintet together.
Yeah, that's right. George was working with a quartet with Buddy DeFranco on clarinet. It turned out Buddy was under contract to another record company, so we couldn't use him. And I suggested using a guitar and vibraphone instead of the clarinet. And so we tried a session that way. And I wrote most of the music for that first session. And George liked the sound, and a few weeks later he signed with MGM Records and made his first big hit record session. He recorded September in the Rain, which is his first hit. And he went on from there and kept the quintet together for something like 27 years.
You know what, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, with varying personnels, but he still had the basic quintet format for all that time.
You know what I guess I'm curious about? You were at the forefront of efforts to desegregate jazz and to have better relations between white and black performers and producers and so on. But were there still tensions between you and certain black artists that you felt incapable of really improving because the history of oppression and bitterness was so lengthy?
I was not aware of any such tension, mainly because I think by that time most musicians knew what my attitudes were and knew that I didn't impose the kinds of conditions on them that, let's say, people at the major record companies had, like the producer for Fats Waller and so forth. I didn't have that kind of a condescending, patronizing attitude towards any musicians, black or white. So I just got along with everybody. I mean, I recorded Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong, Jack Teagarden, and all these great people. And most of the sessions I recall as having been just delightful occasions for me, and in most cases, I think, for the musicians.
My guest is jazz critic, composer, and producer Leonard Feather. He's just written an autobiography titled The Jazz Years. We're going to talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Leonard Feather is my guest. He's written an autobiography titled The Jazz Years, and he's speaking to us from the NPR studios in Los Angeles. You write in your autobiography that music in the 1940s was dominated by big band leaders, publishers, and radio disc jockeys. What's the kind of control that they each had over jazz music?
Well, I think the music publishers had an excessive amount of control. They could more or less dictate what tunes an artist would record, and they were in the kind of position that really made it sometimes very difficult for the artists to do what they really wanted to do. That was the main problem in the music business in those days. The publishers were all powerful, and little by little over the years, or over the decades rather, the artists themselves have taken control. They usually now have their own publishing companies and their own producers, and they decide what's going to be done.
Well, you had a problem yourself. You've composed many songs, and your publisher was Irving Mills, who, when you started writing songs, would take co-composer credit.
That only happened one time.
You wouldn't let it happen again after that.
No, I was actually under contract to Irving Mills for a while, and I wrote quite a few songs that he published, but I have to give him credit. He did get a lot of things recorded for me, and he helped in the fact that Duke Ellington recorded one of my first compositions, something called Mighty Like the Blues. So I really can't put him down entirely. I didn't approve of all his methods. I certainly didn't want him putting his name on my songs, but on the other hand, he did come through when I really needed some help.
But was that a typical thing for publishers to do, to have to get a co-composer credit, thereby getting royalties from a composition that they didn't really write?
Some of them did and some didn't. That varied according to who you're talking about. Of course, a lot of band leaders did it, too. That was very, very common. Even some of the greatest band leaders put their names on compositions because they felt they were publicizing the song, and they had the right, therefore, to take 50% of the song as co-composers. Sometimes they also took another 25% as publishers. So it was a very difficult situation.
Well, Irving Mills, the publisher we were just talking about, is listed as a co-composer on a lot of Duke Ellington compositions.
Yes, that's right, and he probably actually did have some kind of a hand in at least giving Duke the titles of some of the tunes. I don't know how much of the lyrics he actually wrote, but that's a very tricky thing to get into because I have no proof one way or the other of what he did or did not do. I do know that he was very, very helpful to Duke in his overall career, and that's what we should really remember. For a fact, Duke in his autobiography, Music is My Mistress, spoke very kindly of Irving Mills.
You've produced a lot of sessions over the years, and some of the people who you produced would record songs that you've written. Did that ever seem like a possible conflict of interest to you? Would you just see if the musicians wanted to record one of your songs?
Well, I suppose it could be looked as a conflict of interest, except for the fact that more often than not, I went over the material with the artists, and they selected what they did like and didn't like. Like with Dinah Washington, as it turned out, I gave her four blues, two of which turned out to be very, very big hits for her. And so it was doing more good than harm to give them material like that. And when George Shearing made the first session, he wanted to save his compositions for a subsequent date he was going to make for MGM. So I said, well, why don't you just give us some music for this date? So it was his suggestion, not mine. And so forth. It didn't really happen too much that I got involved in composing unless it was a mutual agreement with the artists.
In the 1940s, when Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie came onto the scene and were playing a very new, radical kind of jazz, you were one of their supporters, and a lot of jazz fans thought that all jazz should be traditional New Orleans-based music. And you described the moldy fig wars of the 1940s,
yeah.
Which you were right in the middle of.
Yes, I really was, because I stuck my neck out. I felt that people like Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and Bud Powell and Sarah Vaughan and various others were sort of the wave of the future in jazz, and there were a large number of critics at that time, and even some musicians who objected very violently to my views. And as a matter of fact, I incurred so much hostility on the part of other critics that I started putting pseudonyms on my compositions, because I knew if I didn't, I would get a bad review. And I went on doing that for quite a number of years. But eventually it all died down, and most of the people who had been opposing bebop, which was the new music of the 40s, wound up accepting it and in many cases producing records of it themselves. That's even true of my very good friend, the late John Hammond, who first was really strongly opposed to bebop and eventually became a good friend of Dizzy Gillespie, and he recorded one or two bebop artists.
You know how in a lot of ways the war in Vietnam has never been resolved? The people who took sides back when the war was on are still taking sides now. Is it still that way in the Moldy Fig Wars? The people who were against Parker, aside from John Hammond, do you still not still
There's
hold
hardly
grudge?
Anybody left now except for very, very few diehard reactionary holdouts that really feel as strongly against what was then called the new music, because by now it's more or less traditional. You know, what we thought of as very avant-garde in the 1940s is part of the jazz mainstream today. It's the way most people grow up playing. So it's pretty much impossible to take a position against it.
Jazz critic, composer, and producer Leonard Feather is my guest. Another contribution that you've made to jazz is the production of many sessions by women, musicians as well as vocalists, and you put together several groups of women musicians, women playing by themselves without men. Was that considered strange by male musicians? Words like sexism didn't even exist at the time you were producing these groups.
No, that's right, and we call women girls, too.
That's right. Wait, and chicks.
And chicks, yeah. I made an album called Cats Versus Chicks, but that was the only way to get the album made. It was to put it on the basis of a contest between an all-male group playing certain tunes and an all-female group playing the same tunes back-to-back. And the main thing was that it enabled me to record, say, a very fine trumpeter named Norma Carson, who had never made any records before or since, and a wonderful pianist named Beryl Booker, who died some years ago, whose career I had a large hand in because I produced most of her records. And I recorded an all-female session once with Mary Lou Williams, the only time she ever did that. And I was recorded as far back as my London days. I recorded a wonderful pianist and singer named Una Mae Carlisle. And then I got to convince the people at RCA, one producer there who was very friendly, that I wanted to produce an all-female album called Girls in Jazz. And I got the International Sweethearts of Rhythm, which was a famous big band of that day. And I got another couple of all-star groups, one with Mary Lou Williams, one with Beryl Booker, and one with a bass player named Vivian Gary out here in Los Angeles, and we made a very good album. In those days, the album consisted of 4 78 records, the kind of heavy albums. But that's what it was, an all-female album, the first thing of that kind that was ever done. And I've been recording great female musicians ever since. For example, there's a wonderful young trumpeter out here in Los Angeles named Stacey Rolls. She's the daughter of the pianist Jimmy Rolls. And I produced an album with her a couple of years ago. And I think she is just a remarkable musician. And she still hasn't had the acknowledgement, the reception that she deserves, mainly because there really is still a great deal of sexism in the music industry.
You continue to write jazz criticism, and I think very few jazz critics have kept up with it. Most of them seem to leave for some other part of jazz or some totally different profession. And I can understand why you stayed with it. Why do you think so many people end up giving up jazz criticism?
Well, let's see now. Well, Nat Hentoff hasn't given up jazz criticism. He's just broadened his horizons and is now a really very knowledgeable writer on social and political matters for the Village Voice and other publications. There are a few other critics who have come up to replace those who, most of the old ones have died off. I mean, John Hammond is gone. Charles Edward Smith and some of the other early, Ralph Gleason, another great critic of the 40s and 50s. So it isn't so much a matter of people resigning or quitting criticism. I think there is a new generation of people like Gary Giddens, who's an excellent writer, that is coming along to replace these others.
Jazz is such a small world in a lot of ways, and you've worn so many hats within jazz as critic and composer. And producer, are they ever a conflict of interest? Is it ever a conflict to produce jazz as well as write about it?
There is only a conflict if I write about things that I produce, but I never do that. So I'm very, very careful to avoid any conflict of that kind. If I produced a record or even written the album notes for it without producing it, I still will not write about it, will not review it. So that's the only way to avoid that kind of conflict. And as far as I know, I've done that successfully for a long time.
Is there anything that especially surprises you about recent developments in jazz, things that you would have never expected back in the mid-30s when you first came to America?
Well, yes, it's expanded a great deal in terms of the variety of meters involved. You have jazz in 5/4 time and 11/4 time and various other times. And originally, my whole career was based on the fact that I wrote this provocative letter saying there should be jazz in 3/4 time. Well, now you get that everywhere. And there are much longer, extended compositions, and the whole form of jazz has expanded so much. We used to be confined to mostly 3-minute performances on the 78 RPM records. Now you may have a suite that lasts 20 or 25 minutes. You may have solos that last for many, many choruses. Everything has gotten sort of bigger and in some respects better, although not necessarily just because it's bigger. But it has really improved. And also the musicians nowadays tend to be a great deal better equipped in terms of education. Because when I came up, jazz education was almost a contradiction in terms. Now we have places like the Berklee College of Music in Boston and many, many other colleges around the country where jazz is an official subject for credit courses, not only the history of jazz, but the technique and the instruments and so forth. And we got a lot of wonderful young players coming up out of these schools.
You know, I'm struck listening to you speak that you really don't have much of an English accent anymore.
Oh, that disappeared long ago. I've been an American citizen for almost 40 years.
A lot of people never lose their accent, though, as long as they were in their first country until their early 20s.
Yeah, the difference with me is I really wanted to assimilate. I identified with America. In fact, you know, by the time I come over here, I long since felt that I was less and less a product of my English background, or rather of my American experiences over 4 years of frequent visits to New York.
Okay. Leonard Feather, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
Leonard Feather's autobiography, The Jazz Years, Ear Witness to an Era, is published by DeCapo Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Arlene Violet. She was the first female state attorney general in the country and the first nun in Rhode Island to graduate from law school. She has sued a bishop, investigated corrupt judges, retried Klaus von Bülow, and earned the nickname Attila the Nun. So I hope you can join us. This is Duke Ellington performing Leonard Feather's composition, Mighty Like the Blues.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, theater impresario Joseph Papp explains how a Yiddish-speaking boy from Brooklyn developed a lifelong interest in Shakespeare. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead takes a look at the career of Kansas City pianist Jay McShann, the band leader who helped launch the careers of Charlie Parker and Big Joe Turner. McShann's 1972 album, Going to Kansas City, has just been reissued. Cartoonist Gary Trudeau and director Robert Altman have teamed up on an HBO spoof of political campaigns called Tanner 88, The Dark Horse. Our television critic David Bianculli has a preview. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Today, a boat that had been chartered to carry 100 Palestinian deportees on a protest voyage to Israel was damaged by a bomb explosion. Several groups have claimed responsibility. The BBC's Jim Muir reports.
The PLO was on the point of flying the deportees through that the ship, the Solfrine, had been hulled below the waterline by the mine explosion in Limassol port. So once again, the voyage had to be called off. A 2-foot hole was torn in the hull of the ship, apparently by a limpet mine. But PLO officials say they're determined either to repair the Solfrine or to find a replacement vessel so that the so-called voyage of return can go ahead. Anonymous phone callers claiming to speak on behalf of two Jewish extremist groups, the Jewish Defense League and Kach International, have contacted news agency offices here, saying that they carried out the attack. But the PLO has accused Israeli intelligence of being responsible both for the mine explosion and for the car bomb blast in Limassol on Sunday, in which three senior Palestinian guerrilla officials were killed. In a statement, the PLO warned the Israelis that it might revoke the halt on attacks on Israeli targets abroad, announced by Mr. Arafat in November 1985.
Jim Muir reporting from Nicosia. For the first time since the riots began in the occupied territories of Israel, there was bloodshed in Jerusalem. Today, Israeli police fought with Palestinian demonstrators in the Holy City. Hospital officials say one Arab was wounded by gunfire. Today, the United Nations Human Rights Commission condemned Israel for its policies in the occupied territories. This is the 20th year in a row that the commission has criticized Israel for its handling of the territories. The United States, along with France, West Germany, Italy, and Britain, voted against the measure. But on another vote, the U.S. was the lone dissenter. The commission also condemned Israel for its refusal to apply the Geneva Conventions to Palestinian prisoners. In a televised address to his nation tonight, Austrian President Kurt Waldheim said he intends to stay in office, despite growing pressure to resign. And he said there is no evidence of his personal involvement in war crimes. David Blow reports from Vienna.
Waldheim had some harsh words for his accusers. They'd stopped at nothing, using manipulations, lies, and forgeries against him. But his fellow Austrians, he said, could read the report on his wartime past by the International Commission of Historians. They would not find the evidence that had been sought for 2 years of his involvement in war crimes. It didn't exist. As for the report's criticisms of him, they didn't correspond to the facts and were based on speculations. Waldheim did admit to some possible errors in the way he'd responded to the allegations against him. Waldheim firmly ruled out any question of his resigning. It was a basic principle of Austria's democracy that election results couldn't be altered. It was also a question of justice and fairness towards him personally and of respect for his office. A head of state could not give way, he said, to calumnies, venomous demonstrations, and generalized condemnations. This is David Blow for National Public Radio in Vienna.
A West German government official said today that tens of thousands of Nazi files have disappeared from a records office in West Berlin. Police suspect they may have been sold to military dealers. German officials deny the documents are being used to blackmail former Nazis. British Foreign Secretary Sir Geoffrey Howe today welcomed the new Soviet plan to pull its troops out of Afghanistan. At a luncheon in Moscow given by Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze, Howe said he was anxious to see exactly what the Soviets will do.
The West has no interest in making it more difficult for you to bring your troops home. But we want to see evidence that your good intentions about Afghanistan will be put into practice.
Howe urged Moscow to help bring about a genuinely representative government in Afghanistan. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In 1939, Kansas City pianist and bandleader Jay McShann gave Charlie Parker his first big break. In 1972, McShann and some old and new sidemen recorded a session that has just been reissued. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has this review.
Jay McShann's orchestra is known as the last of the great Kansas City swing bands. It got rolling, in fact, a little too late for its own good, just in time for World War II. Selective service helped kill off the big bands. McShann was one of the many itinerant jazzmen literally drafted off the bandstand. His group had started small in 1937 and expanded to 13 pieces before it broke up in 1944. But whatever its size, its core was always the same. McShann on piano, Gene Ramey on bass, and Gus Johnson on drums. Kansas City is justly famous for its firmly swinging rhythm sections, and this was one of its best. Almost three decades after that band broke up, McShann, Ramey, and Johnson were reunited for a 1972 quintet date, Going to Kansas City, on which McShann sang a couple of blues and played some old favorites. It's now been reissued by New World. From the beginning of his career, McShann had wanted to lead swing bands. But since his earliest sessions, record producers have steered him into smaller units which emphasize the blues. Their reasons are understandable. The Southwestern players who clustered in Kansas City had established a new blues strain, fleet and overtly optimistic. Once you heard a little, it was hard to get enough, and it proved to be a key source for R&B and rock. Kansas City's blues roots were both rural and urban. KC was the crucible where the sound came together, but the musicians who shaped it came from all over. Most of the players on McShann's album hail from Texas. None of them is from Missouri or Kansas. Jay McShann was born in Oklahoma in 1909, or 1916, depending on whether you believe the experts or the man himself. He was either 12 or 5 years younger than Kansas City kingpin Count Basie, an obvious influence. McShann can tread as lightly as Basie, dazzle you like Basie's teacher Fats Waller, or stomp like a country blues man. Listen to his solo on Doggin' Around, first recorded by Basie's band in 1938. Thank you. Jay McShann soaked up other influences, too. The rumba rhythm and saxophone riffs on Hootie's and Hutchinson, the only new tune on the session, parallel Professor Longhair's New Orleans rhythm and blues. Rounding out the quintet on Going to Kansas City are tenor saxophonists Buddy Tate and Julian Dash. Double tenors usually ensure more punch, but here the idea backfires. Tate is a classic Texas tenor. Julian Dash, a veteran of Erskine Hawkins' band, has a similar approach, but less invention and a thinner sound. Together, they actually dilute the small band's impact. You get one voice for the price of two. But if the tenor twins blur together, that just brings the McShann, Gene Ramey, Gus Johnson rhythm section into sharper focus, which is just fine. Once you hear a little of them, it's hard to get enough.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Jay McShann's Going to Kansas City on the New World label. This is Fresh Air. Joseph Papp is arguably American theater's most influential producer. He's famous for creating innovative productions like For Colored Girls and A Chorus Line, and for launching the careers of now illustrious performers such as George C. Scott, James Earl Jones, and Meryl Streep. But throughout his career, in between taking risks on contemporary plays, he always returned to the works of Shakespeare. Last month, Papp began a 6-year series that will present all 36 of Shakespeare's plays. Papp also co-authored a new book called Shakespeare Alive, which is a companion to Bantam's new paperback series of the complete works of Shakespeare. Papp grew up speaking Yiddish as his first language. I asked him how he got interested in Shakespeare.
You know how melodic Yiddish is, really,
yes,
as a
I
language?
Yes, I do, yeah.
And the key to Shakespeare is the melody. You know, the ear is the key to it. But I didn't immediately go from Yiddish to Shakespeare. It's just that I had a teacher, naturally. You get the right teacher who is committed to Shakespeare and loves Shakespeare. And it was just in the junior high school. I sort of stumbled on Julius Caesar. And the word sounded so wonderful, particularly Mark Antony. And I began to memorize just the speeches.
Did you get to the theater much?
No, I didn't know the theater existed.
How'd you find out about it?
Well, later on, they took a bunch of us to, when I was in high school, to see John Gielgud's Hamlet. And that was the first time I went to the theater.
And you loved it?
No, I didn't. I thought he spoke in a phony fashion. I said, why couldn't he speak more naturally? You know, he had a tremolo in his voice. He's become a gorgeous actor now. But when he was young, when I was first exposed to it, the speech sounded very strange. He was British, you know. But it was very, you know, it was, oh, that this too solid flesh would melt. Now, you know, to a kid from Brooklyn and coming from where people spoke in ordinary ways, it was too high class. But I did kind of enjoy the show. But the speech to me, I felt, was too artificial. And so, I mean, later on I became involved with that whole concept of not having artificial British speech, but having good American speech.
In the late 50s, you really made headlines in New York for bringing the free Shakespeare plays to Central Park. And the Parks didn't want you to do it for free.
Not the Parks. It was the Commissioner Parks, Robert Moses. The Parks didn't mind me at all. The trees were welcoming me, and the grass was very responsive. But it was the Commissioner Parks, and it was also the Commissioner of many other things, who objected to the people trampling the grass. And a lot of people sent him bags of birdseed and grass seed and all sorts of things. But there was a great crisis there because we were about to be thrown out. And it made the headlines, you know, day after day. And we finally got to the appellate court. And the appellate court ruled that this imperious man was arbitrary, capricious, and unreasonable. And suggested, they couldn't insist, that we be permitted to play there. And as a result of that, we stayed there.
You were doing Shakespeare, and you were doing it for free outside.
Well, the whole concept of starting...
Why did it have to be Shakespeare, and why for free? Yeah.
That's, we started with Shakespeare. I started with this notion of wanting to bring Shakespeare to the people without charge and play in the city's parks, playgrounds, deal with the Board of Education. It was to bring with the things that I loved to other people. And I felt Shakespeare was understandable. I felt... he'd been taken over too much by the academics, and they were controlling him, and he was being presented in a way that would turn a lot of people off. And so I made it sort of my commitment, and I've been with this for 34 years now, to bring the Shakespeare and to develop American actors to act the works of Shakespeare, and not in a nationalistic way, but just clear, good American speech. The way I'm speaking to you now, I consider that fair American speech. There are people that speak it much better. But without any localisms in the speech, but without removing certain accents. I mean, I've had Raul Julia play all major parts. He's a Hispanic actor, and I don't want to ruin his marvelous accent. But he's clear in his speech. You understand every word. He has a marvelous ear.
One of the things you've really done is find Black, Hispanic, and women playwrights whose work wasn't getting performed to a large public. It seems to me you've probably had to travel to really small theaters and performance spaces and out-of-the-way places to discover people. How do you do it? Do you have a routine for doing that?
No, it's not a routine exactly. Once you begin to operate in the proper way, you begin to generate a particular kind of work. You begin to attract people. I mean, Black writers who thought they would never could be produced would come to me because they know that they have a chance. Black actors, Hispanic actors, they know we're not going to, you know, twit them around and pretend and cast in any kind of, symbolic manner, that we give parts to good actors. I do it because I think it's the right thing and get the best actors, and I think New York is a multiracial community and should be represented on the stage that way.
You've had shows that you nurtured in a nonprofit setting and then they moved on to Broadway, but I don't think you've ever really tried to just move your operation altogether to Broadway.
There's no way to do that, because there's no way to know what play is going to succeed and what is not going to succeed. Broadway is a freelance operation. It's a commercial operation. If I have something that seems to attract a lot of attention, gets good notices, and people want to see it, I have to be very careful, because some of the best plays I do never go to Broadway, because they're too good.
Well, you know, some people have, like, Broadway in their blood, and no matter what they think of Broadway, they have to be on Broadway.
No.
There's a whole mythology. Or was that mythology ever in your system about Broadway?
Never, and still not. In fact, I really don't like Broadway that much, because most of it is vulgar. I mean, most of the things that are put on stage. I mean, I produced plays, and you'll find I always have one standard of work. I would do the same thing downtown at my small theaters. I have five small theaters in one building. In Greenwich Village, as I would do on Broadway or in the park. There's not a double standard. I say, well, I'm going to do this in a commercial way. I don't know what that means. I mean, we either do it well or we don't do it well. It has certain advantages. I like the popularity of Broadway. And the reason I go to Broadway is two reasons. One is that it's important for us. We have to make money because we give a lot of things away for nothing. We play free in the park, and that's $2.5 million. And we need to have successes from time to time. That's one reason. The other reason, and it's closely allied, is you do reach a large popular audience on Broadway. In small theaters, you reach 200, 300 people a night.
On Broadway, a critic can really kill a play overnight.
Not a critic. One critic can kill a play.
That's critic for the New York Times, you mean?
That's correct. The New York Times has the greatest readership for people who go to the theater, and actually they're influenced by the first string critic, which would be Frank Rich in this particular case, who has a tremendous power, not personally, but the fact that he's backed by this paper that has this kind of readership.
You have a reputation for actually picking up the phone, calling a critic, and bawling him or her out for a bad review that you thought was unjustified. Is that just reputation, or is that really true?
No, I've done that, and we'll continue to do that from time to time. I feel they're stupid, and sometimes they are utterly dumb.
Isn't it impolitic to bawl out a theater critic?
Yes, it is in politics. I've thrown theater critics out of the theater. That's more in politics. I threw Walter Kerr out of my theater.
What'd you tell him?
Told him to get the hell out. I used a fancier word than that. And because he had no right to be there. It was a preview, and he had no right. We weren't ready to invite critics. And the same thing with John Simon. I just got him by the tie one night and just sort of pushed him around a little bit because I felt the way he mistreated people was terrible. I mean, the way he said about actors, that's cruel, that kind of stuff. I mean, critics have the right to criticize. They can say anything they like. But when they start to become personal about actors' appearances or they become snide and all that stuff, well, then I don't need them.
Do you have theater nightmares?
And what sort, you mean?
Dreams, literally dreams.
I dream about the theater?
Yeah.
Well, all dreams are theater. Because you, in a dream, you're both the actor, the director, and you're also the scenery.
But you don't roll the credits at the end.
Sometimes you do, or the discredits at the end.
But do you have the equivalent of dreams where you walk out of stage
when I'm working on
flies
a play?
And zip.
Oh, well, you know, the worst dream you have, whether you're an actor or a director or anything, is that you come on and you don't know the lines. In fact, you don't know what play you're on. And you're on the stage, and there are thousands of people out there, and you say, well, what is the first line?
You direct and you produce. Did you ever really want to act?
I've acted. I was in Death of a Salesman on the road company.
But you didn't stay with it.
No, it's too hard to act. It's the most difficult of all the professions because you have to be extremely vulnerable. You have to give yourself to the thing completely. I like to perform occasionally, and I do. I've been offered a lot of films, and I just don't do them because they're boring kind of things. But I enjoy performing. But to make a career of it, which means suddenly you're in a... Well, the worst thing is to be in a hit show where you have to do 8 performances a week. That's very tiresome. I don't know how some actors do it.
Well, you direct them.
I know. But I go through the process and help me create the role, and then I don't have to be there every night as they do. It's a whole different thing. We say goodbye to each other for a little while, and they're sort of on their own then, you see.
Joseph Papp is currently presenting Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Public Theater in New York. Julius Caesar is next in the cycle. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hiya, Terry.
What stories are you following?
Well, we're following the campaigning up in New Hampshire. Tomorrow is the first true primary of the 1988 presidential campaign year. And we'll have reports from Linda Wertheimer on the Democrats, Cokie Roberts on what the voters are saying. We'll also be hearing about the campaign video that's been produced for the Dole campaign. Several campaigns have these. They pass them around and people watch them at home and get a sense of what the candidate's all about. That reports of some new rhetoric for Vice President George Bush. Also, news of economic reform in Nicaragua and that explosion in the ferry boat in Cyprus that the Palestinians were going to take back to Israel.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. During the past 3 football seasons, Home Box Office has done a series called First in 10 about a fictional football team's quest for the Super Bowl. Now with Tanner 88, the dark horse, HBO is moving the concept from the sports arena into the political arena. Television critic David Bianculli has this review.
Just in time for the New Hampshire primary, a new presidential candidate has entered the race. His name is Jack Tanner. His slogan is "The future is now," and he's a liberal Democrat. So liberal that he sees Vietnam and Watergate as triumphs.
Vietnam may have covered some patriots in shame, but not this one. We got in there for moral reasons, and by God, we got out of there for moral reasons. Where else on this earth does such debate center on anything other than expediency? Only in America. Watergate, triumph of the system. How could anybody watch Barbara Jordan thunder away at those House hearings and not feel a surge of pride in the miracle of this country?
If Tanner sounds too good to be true, that's because he is. He's played by actor Michael Murphy, who's been in a lot of movies by Woody Allen and Robert Altman. And where some candidates create their images through television, Jack Tanner is created by and for television. You can see him for the first time on HBO's Tanner 88, The Dark Horse, which premieres right before the New Hampshire primary and is repeated all through February. In March, HBO will present a second special, Tanner 88 For Real. The obvious comparisons here are the Pat Paulson for President campaigns and the unsuccessful Showtime cable TV version of Washington, the Village Voice comic strip that invented a moronic but charismatic congressman named Bob Forehead. But the first Jack Tanner special is different from those fabricated campaigns because sometimes it takes its politics very seriously. And why not? Jack Tanner is written by Doonesbury creator Gary Trudeau, who's always mixed humor in politics, and it's directed by Robert Altman, who did such wonderful things with the absurdity of the campaign trail in Nashville. There's a lot of out-and-out humor in Tanner 88, but the more outrageous the show gets, the less effective it is. As a matter of fact, it takes a lot of effort to get through, because a lot of the comedy is too broad and too dull. But stay with it, because the closer the show gets to reality, the better it is. It starts to pick up about halfway through, when the people running Tanner's campaign test out a new TV ad on a New Hampshire focus group. The technology behind the testing and the sophistication of the audience's reaction is very real, and as a result, very funny. And there's nothing more real or more funny than watching Tanner interact with real-life presidential hopefuls Pat Robertson, Robert Dole, and Gary Hart.
Nice, oh, this is my daughter, Alex.
Hi, how are you? Gary Hart, very nice to see you. So how's it going?
Fine. I'm tired. How do you feel?
I gave you a plug in there, so don't get him.
I'll take care of you.
Good luck in there.
I want to beat you, but I'd rather have you in there than Kemp.
Yeah, well, I understand. Well, same is true of you, right?
Hey, you? Jack, how you doing?
You're killing them.
Oh, you're really closing a gap, right?
Well, I'm hanging on by my fingernails.
You're doing a great job.
No,
that's
well, thanks very much. Yeah. But you're really something. You're really doing it.
Oh, we got them on the run.
Yes, we have.
Beating the bushes.
Yeah, we have. Yes. Well, I think it's going to be you and me in the final stretch. Yeah. I can hang him.
Tearing them up in my home state.
Well, Michigan is a strong one for me. You
I'll
know
say.
That, Jack.
I'll tell you, it made me glad to be a Democrat. I wouldn't want to be up against you.
The unstated but implied question, of course, is which candidate is real and which is Memorex? Like many candidates, Tanner's gotten off to a shaky start, but he's done well enough to earn some respect and some support. All he needs is a more realistic script and a better theme song.
Exercise your right to vote. Choose the one you like the most.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Next time in our continuing series of interviews with Fresh Air contributors, we'll get a glimpse of another side of Lloyd Schwartz. In addition to his classical music criticism, Lloyd also writes poetry. And in celebration of Mardi Gras, rock historian Ed Ward will examine the music of the festival as performed by Professor Longhair, the Neville family, and the Hawkettes. And book critic John Leonard will review the new novel by African writer Chinua Achebe, entitled Anthills of the Savannah. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Danny Miller directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.